to hear argument in our second case, United States versus Foreman. A little bit of color in this dreadful weather.
Well, I'm a University of Georgia Bulldog too. I can't help it. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Amy Lee Copeland. I represent the appellant Evan Foreman. With me today is my colleague Scott Morris, who represents the appellant Michael Foreman, who is also Evan's brother. I will discuss today the issues of the appeal waiver and the 3E1.1B claim, and Mr. Morris will discuss his client's career offender designation. As an initial matter, this court should decline to dismiss this appeal based upon the appeal waiver and instead hear its merits. In this case, both defendants signed plea agreements that generally waived a sentencing appeal if their sentence fell within the guidelines range, and the district court so advised them at the Rule 11 hearing. But what happened in this case is at the sentencing hearing, the district judge says to the parties, "Can you tell me about this appeal waiver?" And Mr. Morris first responds, "Listen, it's the standard appeal waiver as far as I can tell. I can double check it if you would like." And then the government says about this appeal waiver that, "Listen, Judge, the defendants can challenge whether you, the district judge, incorrectly calculated the guidelines in order to arrive at that sentence." The judge even asked the prosecutor to clarify this. "Does this go to our career offender determination?" "Yes, it does." This colloquy between the prosecutor and the district judge continues for about three or four questions. And then the judge says then we need to take up some other issues. And then it begins to address Mr. Michael Foreman's career offender guideline. It's our position this morning that those statements amounted to an oral modification of the plea agreement.
You think the government can unilaterally change the plea agreement?
Sure. It's the draft.
Unilaterally?
Unilaterally, yes.
Without any agreement from you. So the government could have said the plea agreement is... would be more onerous to you, and that would be all right.
Your Honor,
that would have changed it.
Well, and you raise
well,
an excellent
so you
point. So maybe you're right.
So maybe
I don't want
that.
To go that far. But in this situation, certainly, the way the Fourth Circuit's
It was at sentencing.
It was at sentencing. That's correct, Your Honor.
Already entered his plea. Had the plea been accepted?
Your Honor, I wish I could answer that confidently for you. In my district,
what's the record show on whether the plea had been accepted? Had the plea been accepted at the time of the plea, or was the acceptance of the plea reserved till the sentencing proceeding?
Your Honor, I believe that it was accepted at the time of the plea, but as I'm sitting here, I will have an answer for you about that at rebuttal. I apologize for not being able to answer that to you now.
That might be the shooting match then.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that, Judge King. And like I said, I apologize for not knowing.
Well, there are days, maybe weeks, go by between the time the plea is entered and the sentencing?
That is correct, Your Honor. Months, I think, is fair to say in this case.
Right.
But looking at this court's jurisprudence about plea agreements, you construe it against the government, the drafter, because it's not a typical deal between contracting parties. Of course, it's more, I hesitate to say it, an easy contract, but the government really does have greater bargaining power. And in this case, my clients, I think, are entitled to hear what the government says, the government's interpretation of its own contract. And at the sentencing hearing, the government interpreted the contract in a way that gives my clients the right to pursue this appeal on the merits. And from a standpoint of having my client being able to trust what the government says, I think that you all should hear its appeal on the merits. Just speaking personally, and of course not on the record, my client very much did listen to what the government said and heard the government to say in this case that he could appeal. And just from the PSI,
he'd already agreed he couldn't appeal. At that point, he'd already entered into agreement. Now the question is whether it's been accepted or not. I don't know the answer either.
Right.
But if he can appeal, what have you got? What kind of issues you got?
Sure, Your Honor, the issue that my client raises exclusively, and Mr. Michael Foreman has a second issue, just goes to this whole notion of 3E1.1B. Acceptance of responsibility. It requires a timely notification of intent to plead, thereby permitting the government to avoid preparing for trial and permitting the government and the court to allocate their resources efficiently. My client got arrested in June 2011. At that time, he made a confession, not to all 11 substantive acts and eventually contained in the third superseding indictment, But he admitted to a number of those acts. He tried to plead. Plea negotiations continued throughout the case. He and his attorney consented to 4 Speedy Trial Act motions throughout the case. The first two, all of them were filed by the government. The first two represented that plea negotiations were ongoing. The second two talked about the government wanted to avoid preparation for trial, or they had an extensive trial ahead and they would need to gear up the machinery if this case had not been resolved. Your Honor, my client continued to agree to those, and eventually he and the government did strike a plea deal. Michael Foreman's plea agreement was about 12 months after he first became involved in the federal court proceedings. Evan Foreman's pleading was about 15 months after he became involved in these federal...
How long before trial was it?
Your Honor, I believe that Evans was the later. It was about a couple months before trial, 3 months maybe. He was in August of 2011. Trial was scheduled for November of 2011. I think it's significant that the docket sheet does not reflect that any motions in limine, voir dire, request to charge, anything of that nature had been filed on the docket by the time my client entered his guilty plea. What strikes me as particularly interesting is at page 153 of the joint appendix, in arguing against this extra level of reduction for the Foreman brothers, the government makes this statement: the majority of the conduct was charged in the third superseding indictment and is disputed by the defendants. In fact, the only conduct to which the defendants were willing to plead guilty was that to which they affirmatively confessed in post-arrest statements. Multiple prior plea offers containing additional relevant conduct by the defendants were rejected. So, from reading this statement, and as the appellate lawyer, I was not involved in the...
How many counts was your man?
My man had, I believe, 11 substantive...
And how many did he plead guilty to?
He pleaded guilty to the conspiracy charge that encompassed...
He pleaded guilty to one?
Correct, Your Honor.
Is that what they wanted him to plead guilty to at the beginning?
Your Honor, again, I was not involved in these negotiations.
Well, but
Mr. Morris, I get that, Judge.
You're the only one here answering questions.
I get that, Your Honor. And the record shows, as I understand the record, the conspiracy offer was what was on the table plus a 924C for my client.
He ended up with the conspiracy.
He ended up with the conspiracy, and he ended up with the 924C.
You pled guilty to the 924C also?
He did, yes.
You pled guilty to 2 counts?
He did.
I thought you said you pled guilty to 1 count.
He pled guilty to a conspiracy count. I'm sorry, not any substantive Hobbs Act. And when you look at the
did
elements...
Did he plead guilty to 1 count or 2 counts?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. He pled guilty to 2 counts.
Correct.
One count was a substantive.
All right, you had 11 counts of
conspiracy.
Pled guilty to 2, and at the beginning of the plea negotiations, had they asked him to plead guilty to 2?
That is my understanding from reading the record, and the two.
He pled guilty. There was no change in the from the beginning to the end as to what they wanted him to plead to.
That is my understanding from reading the record. He was willing to plead guilty to conspiracy to commit Hobbs Act, which doesn't require you.
And he pled guilty 2 or 3 months before the trial.
That is correct. After it had been extended a number of times.
And he was specifically put to him if he understood that he was waiving his right to give up, you're agreeing to give up your right to appeal any sentence.
Your Honor, that
yes, sir.
That was part of the plea agreement, and that was undertaken at the Rule 11 colloquy.
And he was expressly, it wasn't even just in a written plea agreement. He was asked the question by the district court. Yes, sir.
Your Honor, the facts are what they are, and
I want you to acknowledge the facts.
Your Honor,
they are.
Yes, the facts are. If you read the Rule 11 transcript, the district judge did go over the appeal waiver with
him. Sort of excruciating detail.
Wanted to make sure that he understood the difference between the sentence if he were a career offender and the sentence if he were not deemed to be a career offender,
and that he'd given up his right to appeal.
Your Honor, that is also part of what the Rule 11 colloquy is. But then at the sentencing hearing, when asked to explain the terms of that agreement, the government then says that he can appeal the issue that he now raises.
And what's the impact of the fact that the government didn't raise the appeal waiver in its opening brief?
Your Honor, I think the rules are pretty clear that you have to raise all issues in contention in your opening brief.
What about, is there some established law that you know about that if you raise it in a motion, the court denies the motion, that you have to re-raise it?
Candidly, Your Honor, I could not find that law.
Right.
To be perfectly honest with you, could not.
Those are the facts we have here.
Those are the facts we have here. The government did, in fact, file a motion to dismiss raising this ground.
The government didn't raise it in their opening brief. They raised it before that in a motion. And they misrepresented to the court what the plea agreement said about waiver. correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
But got all kinds of twists and turns here.
It does, Your Honor.
And then you, and then the, and you want to, you just want to raise that one issue?
That's it, Your Honor, is the 3E1.1B issue.
Okay.
Based on a client who would have pleaded to this early and agreed without opposition to all sorts of speedy trial motions.
Okay,
thank you. And I'll finally answer your question, Judge.
Yeah, no, we appreciate you.
May it please the court, I'd like to address the issue of whether the district court erred when it concluded that my client, Michael Foreman, was a career offender. And in this case, the district court did err because it applied the wrong burden of proof in analyzing two of Michael Foreman's three predicate convictions underlying that determination.
Now, he's got the same issue on the appeal waiver that we just argued?
Yes, Your Honor.
Identical.
Yes.
So we have heard that. Okay.
The identical issue, and I adopt the arguments of...
But if you get past that, you want to raise the career offender and the acceptance of responsibility?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I would rely on the comments of my esteemed colleague with regard to those first two issues that she's addressed. Michael Foreman introduced substantial objective evidence from the court files with regard to both of the convictions that are at issue, both of those prior convictions. And that objective evidence cast serious doubt as to whether he was represented by counsel when he entered his guilty pleas to those counts in Baltimore City. Thus, Michael Foreman met his burden of production by introducing objective evidence sufficient to support a reasonable inference that his pleas were uncounseled. However, the district court erred by assigning Michael Foreman the ultimate burden of proof. The district court should have assigned the burden of proof to the government and required the government to show by preponderance of the evidence that the pleas were, in fact, counseled.
Even when, in fact, we are supposed to apply a strong presumption of regularity to these records, that suggests that the onus is on your client to show otherwise.
Your Honor, it's clear from the Park decision by the Supreme Court and other decisions of this court that there is a presumption of regularity that attaches to final judgments. The applying to the defendant a burden of production does not undermine and, in fact, supports the presumption of regularity. The presumption of regularity assumes that the underlying conviction is valid until the defendant comes forward with some objective evidence to show otherwise. But once the defendant has come forward with something other than a silent record, other than his own self-serving statements, but comes forward with objective evidence, that then satisfies that burden of production, which overcomes the presumption of regularity. And at that point, under circumstances like we have here, where the defendant's claim is that his plea was uncounseled, then the burden should shift to the government to show by a preponderance of the evidence that the guilty plea was counseled. So we're not arguing against the presumption of regularity. We believe that applying a burden of production takes into account that presumption of regularity. If the district court had applied the correct burden, I believe the record is clear that the government would not have met its burden. And the district court would have then found that the two prior convictions could not be counted for sentencing guideline purposes, and thus that Michael Foreman was not a career offender. And this would have had a dramatic effect on the advisory guideline range that would have been applicable to Michael Foreman. As the court found it, his advisory guidelines as a career offender were the range between 151 to 188 months, whereas if he were not a career offender and those convictions were not counted against him, then his guideline range would have been in the range of 51 to 63 months. So a difference of more than 12 years down to a sentencing range more in the realm of 5 years.
Of course, the district court in this case said that even if there was a mistake, that it would have applied, would have entered the same sentence, suggesting that any error in this case was harmless. How do we deal with that?
Yes, Your Honor. But as the court's aware, the harmless error rule has two aspects to it, and we believe that the second prong is not satisfied. That is that the resulting sentence would have to be reasonable despite the error. And we submit that it would be patently unreasonable for a district court to impose a sentence of 12 years on a defendant whose sentencing guideline range was more in the range of 5 years. Personally, I'm not familiar with or aware of any decision in the District of Maryland where a judge would have made such a dramatic change from the advisory guideline range. Typically, judges stick pretty close to the guidelines. If there's a departure, it's often downward. Even a slight upward departure would be somewhat unusual. But
in the District of Maryland.
In the District of Maryland, and perhaps through this circuit, but you would know better. But I would argue that an upward variance going from a 5-year range up to a 12-year range would be unreasonable. And I would further argue that it would be patently unreasonable for the district court in this particular case, if the court remands, for the court to impose the exact same sentence if, in fact, this court's determination is that, as a result of applying Park, that Mr. Foreman is not a career offender.
I think your time has expired. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. Mr. Block, first I want to credit you for coming yourself.
Thank you, Your Honor. These self-inflicted wounds are the worst.
They are.
We're certainly here today because I made a mistake at sentencing. And as much as AUSAs strive to be perfect in their representations to the court, sometimes mistakes are made. And the question here with respect to the waiver is, what should the effect of my mistake at the sentencing hearing be? And I would submit to the court that there should be no effect with respect to the plea agreement because of the specific circumstances here.
So we let lawyers negligently misrepresent facts to the court willy-nilly.
I certainly wouldn't go so
You're
far,
speaking
Your
to
Honor.
A former United States attorney, and those are the people, as you may know from the District of Maryland, that hold the United States Attorney's Office to their highest best.
And I certainly respect that.
Well, I think any rule ought to apply to every lawyer, though. If a judge asks a question here, this courtroom, or in Maryland, or anywhere else, the judge expects to get the straight scoop from the lawyer. And I'm not casting any aspersions on you intentionally, that you intentionally misled the judge, but if you don't know the answer, then you say you don't know. We do that. You did that all the time, or when it needs to be, I'm sure.
Certainly, Your Honor.
But when you make representations to the judge, they got to be accurate.
Absolutely.
We all agree with that.
Absolutely.
And if it's a situation like this, it seems to me the simple solution for the government would have been, when it came up here, we're not going to seek to enforce the plea waiver because he agreed to it, and we mistakenly misled the court at the sentencing proceeding as to what it provided. So we're willing to litigate the issues on the merits and let the chips fall.
Well,
about 98% of the time when you come up here, you win anyway.
Certainly that was one option, but and certainly, had I made this mistake at the time of the plea agreement, I would not be here asking for this case to be dismissed. There's no question about that. And certainly, if the mistake at sentencing had been one that was to the detriment of the defendants, I would not be here asking for my statement to be ignored. But in this particular case, this was not a situation in which there was detrimental reliance by the defendants at the time that they entered the plea. There was not even, I don't think the record shows any detrimental reliance by the district court based on my statement in making his sentencing finding. And frankly, I think it would be improper for him to take into account whether or not his decision was appealable in making his ruling. His obligation is to make the best finding that he can, and there's nothing in the record that would suggest that he did otherwise.
The district court have the written waivers in front of him? Didn't sound like, from my reading of the record, he was relying on you to tell him what the
he certainly had them at the time the pleas were entered. I'm not sure. He certainly must not have been looking at them at the time he asked me the question, and frankly, neither was I, and that was my mistake. But
Is this provision sort of unusual?
No appeal? No,
oh.
This is the standard. And in fact, both Mr. Morris and myself, our initial response to Judge Bedard was, it's the standard waiver of appeal.
Uh-huh.
And then there were follow-up questions, and that's where I misspoke.
I'm sorry. My question was not clear. Was the actual thing that exists the norm, or was what you told the district court the norm?
The actual provision in the plea agreement, written paragraph in the plea agreement.
Is the norm.
Is the norm. What I said was not the norm.
Right.
And frankly, there were, this plea negotiation was protracted, and I'll talk about that a little bit with respect to the acceptance of responsibility point. But there is a presumption in this case, or presumption in this circuit, that written appellate waivers are to be enforced. And there is an integration clause in these plea agreements, paragraph 14 of Michael Forman's agreement at Joint Appendix 118, paragraph 16 of Evan Forman's agreement at Joint Appendix 139, that say these agreements cannot be changed without a writing signed by both parties. And to permit an oral modification here where the mistake did not harm or cause prejudice to the defendants in any way, basically renders integration clauses in plea agreements
nullity. Well, but your concession, which, you know, good for you, where you said if there had been detrimental reliance, you wouldn't be making this argument, that would seem to be contrary to the integration clause as well. If there had been an oral representation by the government upon which the court or the parties had relied, right?
It would, but that's a situation where fundamental fairness and due process may trump
The integration clause,
but there isn't that here. And indeed, the detrimental reliance case from this circuit, which is Wood, that's really a plea colloquy.
But why do we need the detrimental reliance in a situation like this? Why wouldn't we just sanction the government for a situation like it, or sanction whichever side it comes from, where a lawyer negligently misrepresents to the court? If the lawyer intensely misrepresents, I think it's probably a disbarment offense. We don't have that here. But a lawyer negligently misrepresents to the court, we can't have that either. It headed off at the pass, kind of.
That's certainly an option for the court, however.
Don't worry about any of these other things. Just say we're not going to pay attention to this thing and go right on to the merits of the case. And here you didn't even raise it in your first appeal brief anyway.
Well,
and you got the argument, well, we raised it in a motion, which was denied. So we didn't think we had to raise it anymore.
It was less that we didn't think we had to raise it and more that we thought that the issue had been resolved against us. And at that point, we didn't see the need to belabor an issue that the court had ruled on. When the supplemental briefing order came down, it became clear that that was a misunderstanding on our part, which we apologize for. But certainly the fact that the motion was denied suggested to us that this was not a proper issue for briefing and argument. I certainly understand your concerns regarding my misrepresentation, and if I could address, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, well, that was nice of you to step in. I hadn't even asked. I guess that your argument is that in this case it doesn't really make any difference to you because you think that you win if we look at the merits of these arguments. What you might be worried about is the next case where there is a negligent misrepresentation by the government after there has been a written plea agreement accepted by the defendant. And should the government, the people, the United States, if you will, be put in, be held against them where it would make a difference on the merits?
Yes, Your Honor.
I think you're hoping there is not going to be a next case, at least as far as you're concerned.
Well, there won't be for me.
Yeah, no, I don't think there will be.
but yes, Your Honor's point is correct. This is the reason why we have integration clauses, because despite our best efforts, occasionally mistakes are made.
But see, I come back to the fact that you've said that if there had been reliance, you wouldn't have relied on the integration clause.
Well,
are we just supposed to, I mean, I'm probably willing to defer to the United States Attorney's Office as much as anyone else, but is this all within your discretion, whether you're going to rely on it or not?
Certainly seeking to enforce it is within our discretion, and the reason why I say if there were detrimental reliance or a violation of fundamental rights that we would stand by our misstatement is because that's what the case law has suggested, that's what Wood suggests, that's what Martin suggests. And those are very, very different cases from what's here. In Martin, the government said that the defendant had earned a 5K motion, but they were going to wait for a Rule 35B motion, and that motion was improper. And the defendant was thereby deprived of something he was entitled to. That's a very, very different situation from this. And in Wood, there were misstatements made at the time the guilty plea was entered about what exactly the defendant could challenge at sentencing. So that is a very different case. This case is more like the cases that we cite with respect to judicial misstatements regarding the waiver of appeal. And I still certainly take Judge King's point very seriously, but the effect on the defendants with respect to either reliance or their fundamental rights is the same as if the judge had misspoken about the appellate.
Suppose there's still an open question as to when this plea was accepted. Does that matter?
In fact, I believe that it would. However, in this case, these pleas were accepted at the time of the rearrangements for Michael Forman on July 2nd.
So they were accepted at the plea proceeding?
At the plea proceeding. And the pleas were entered on the docket at that time. And that's reflected in
the judge said, "I accept the pleas of guilty in the plea agreement."
Yes, and that would be contained in the transcripts I attached to our motion to dismiss, exhibits A and B. I don't have the specific page site, but he certainly, at the conclusion of those guilty plea hearings, accepted their pleas of guilty. Let me, with the few minutes that I have remaining, let me address the two substantive issues, which, if the court decides to consider them, I think that they, I think they're interesting points for clarification for our practice in the district court. With respect to the 3E1.1 issue with regard to the third level, if this is not a case in which the government is not entitled to withhold the motion, then I'm not sure that there's any case where the government could withhold the motion. As early as February 7th of 2012, and this is in District Court ECF number 79, I filed a letter with the district court stating that plea negotiations were not ongoing with Evan Forman and that a plea with Michael appeared not imminent. And in the context, that was filed in the context of a speedy trial motion that had been challenged by Evan Forman. For me to say, in the context of trying to get a speedy trial order, that plea negotiations...
It's an admission against interest.
Exactly. Exactly. That's how far plea negotiations had fallen off in this case. And it wasn't simply an issue of how much conduct Evan and Michael were willing to agree to. It was a question of how much time they were willing to serve. My initial plea offer to Evan Forman was 25 years, C plea, and he could, I certainly provided a statement of facts, but if he had said, "I'll take the 25, but I'm not willing to admit to this and that," then he would have been able to plea and we would have gone on our way. So it was not simply the conduct that was at issue, it was the length of the sentence. And as the court knows, the plea agreement that we ultimately arrived at reflected just how difficult these negotiations were. There was a provision if he is found to be a career offender, a provision if he's not found to be a career offender. This was all the result of a protracted discussion, and he was never willing to admit. I wouldn't even say that this is true relevant conduct. I would say that this is part and parcel of the offense of conviction, the conspiracy, count one, to which he pled guilty, that his admission of guilt with respect to count one, the conspiracy, was not sufficient to permit the district court to impose a just punishment. He was willing to admit that he conspired, but he was unwilling to admit the scope of the conduct that would allow the district court to understand what a just punishment would be. And that is why we had this extended sentencing hearing that lasted almost the entire day.
But he pled what she said a couple of months before the trial was going to be set.
Well, the timing of his actual plea in advance of trial doesn't necessarily reflect the amount of trial preparation.
Well, was her representative correct that he pled a couple of months before the plea, before the trial was to begin?
The trial was originally scheduled for September 10th. Well, let me back up one step further. There was a motions hearing in May, and there was a motion for severance. And after analyzing the evidence in the case to determine whether or not we could successfully proceed on a joint trial, the government conceded that motion and agreed to a severance. Michael Forman was then set for trial September 10th, and Evan's trial was not scheduled until November. Michael pled in July, Evan pled in September, so both of them pled
2 months before their trial.
2 months before their trials. However, from May 15th until July 2nd, when Michael Forman pled, I was preparing for two trials at that point. And from July 2nd until September 13th, when Evan Forman pled, I was preparing for Evan Forman's trials. That was essentially 4 months of trial preparation that I was engaged in with respect to these defendants. And that included interviewing witnesses, it included issuing subpoenas, it included obtaining new evidence in the form of phone records. The agent in this case listened to literally hundreds of hours of jail calls, and that's reflected in the sentencing transcript. Hundreds of hours of jail calls involving the defendants in order to obtain new evidence for trial. And so that work was all trial preparation. And the fact that it wasn't ultimately used for a trial doesn't affect my determination that I had expended significant amounts of resources preparing for a trial because we could not reach a plea agreement. And to their point that, well, they would have pled to, you know, they would have pled a year earlier had I been willing to accept what they were willing to plead to, that's not how plea negotiations work.
So they get more time because they drive a hard bargain, or the lawyer drives a hard bargain.
Well,
that's sort of what the adversary system is all about.
And they could have pled guilty at any time without a plea agreement.
They could have pled straight up.
That's right. That's right. Or they could have pled just to the counts that they wanted to plead to. So
you would have taken them to the trial on the rest of
them. Or not.
Then it would have been my choice, but they certainly would have been entitled to.
Wouldn't make a lot of sense.
They would have been entitled to the acceptance of responsibility credit. So I think that, and if you look at Divens, this case isn't, they aren't compelled to receive the third point by Divens. I don't think Divens even truly supports their argument for a third point when you look at the cases cited favorably in that decision. And I know that Judge Motz is very familiar with that decision, but the Beatty case cited favorably, that is a case that deals almost entirely with the efforts that the government had to make at sentencing in order to resolve issues of factual dispute. So I think Divens ultimately supports our position that that a third level is not appropriate here. And with respect to the burden of proof, with respect to the prior convictions, I think that this is, if not settled law in this circuit, certainly the case law strongly suggests that the burden not only of production but also of proof is on the defendant when collaterally challenging a prior conviction in federal court. Not only does Park v. Raley cite approvingly a variety of decisions in which the entire burden is placed on the defendant, but the Jones case out of the Fourth Circuit and then followed up by Hondo in 2004, the court says that this is an especially difficult burden that the defendant bears, that he has the burden of proving that the conviction was invalid. That's from Hondo. And in Hondo, Your Honor dissented on the facts of that case, but even in your dissent, you recognized that the burden of proof was on the defendant. You said, I recognize that the burden is on Hondo to demonstrate that he was not aware of the dangers, et cetera, et cetera. I believe that he has made that burden and proved by a clear preponderance of the evidence that his right to counsel was not effectuated there. So even in dissent, Your Honor recognized that this is a burden for the defendant, and the facts of this case don't support invalidating the convictions. The robbery conviction from 1996 listed an attorney, James Salkin, present at the time of his guilty plea. And there was an earlier reference, that entry is at Joint Appendix 204. At Joint Appendix 226, there was a reference from almost a year earlier of a letter from Mr. Salkin to the clerk's office that was forwarded to the Office of the Public Defender, which indicates that that's the point at which Mr. Salkin entered the case. There'd be no reason for him to be referenced in the docket if he were simply stand-in counsel. So the record on that in that case supports finding that the conviction was valid. And I'm sorry, I'm over time.
I have one question I wanted to ask you, and I appreciate your discussion of the merits of these claims, but I want to get back to a point that Judge King made, is that obviously without a concession by the government, we're going to have to address the question of waiver, and it may, of course, I'm not predicting how that's going to come out. But given the unique circumstances of this case, and I appreciate your honest concession that you made a mistake here, wouldn't it be appropriate, as Judge King suggested, to say, under the unique circumstances of this case, we're simply not going to rely on the waiver? And you also said that these issues present interesting points of law that might clarify our practice in Maryland, which might suggest that you might want us to reach the merits.
You have been jerked around by us on this. You know, first we denied it, then we asked you for a briefing on it, then we asked you if we could reach it. So I would be in favor of letting you go back to your office and talk about whether or not you would be willing to drop
I appreciate the waiver that, because argument. My response was going to be, I don't think that I have authority at this point.
Above my pay grade.
But
I don't want to misrepresent anything.
I'll give you some more advice then. If you come down here again in one of these tough situations, have authority.
Okay.
I mean, we need to be able to speak to whoever we have standing there.
But in fairness, we in this particular case, we indicate one thing one day and one thing the next day. I can understand why you were a little unclear.
I appreciate that, Your Honor, and I will check with my office.
And send us a letter with a copy to the other side telling us what your position is with foregoing the waiver claim.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you.
So we're going to have to wait for coming attractions on that argument, but you can go ahead and make your arguments.
Thank you. Judge King, my opponent is correct. The judge did accept the plea agreements at the guilty plea, and I apologize for not knowing that previously.
Some courts do it differently. I mean, we see it where they hold it off till the sentencing and prove the plea agreement the last minute.
And that's my home court's practice also, Judge.
Right.
If you'll look at the JA 294, the judge does make a statement after going through what the plea says about the appeal waiver. All right, that's for the record. In light of that, I think it's necessary then, Mr. Morris, to review the third conviction. So there is some indication from the record, at least, that the judge did make some different decisions or go into some areas that perhaps he would not have without this indication. Prior to that discussion of what the appeal waiver said, on JA 288, the district court does say, for the Court of Appeals, OPD in Maryland means Office of Public Defender. So there's a little bit of suggestion that the judge is conducted sentencing somewhat differently based upon the representations. JA 293 also has what was said about the time, are there appeal waivers in your plea agreement? Mr. Morris, I believe they're the standard terms. I'd have to double-check, Your Honor. Mr. Block, it's the standard waiver of conviction, that they have not waived the right to contest the court's sentencing determinations with respect to criminal history. And talking again about the briefing issue, candidly, I thought the issue of the appeal waiver was why you set it for oral argument, because I got the oral argument notice immediately after the motion to dismiss and the response. So as an advocate, I was just surprised not to see it in the brief, but I do understand that they made their motion. Turning back then to the 3E1.1B issue, the government says that the plea negotiations initially weren't focused on conduct, but more on the time that he would get to serve. You plead guilty to an offense of conviction, not a particular sentence in this case. It's my position that Evan and Michael were both willing to plead guilty to the conspiracy charge in count one, and Evan later also to the 924C in count 11 of the third superseding indictment. And that the conduct, they pled guilty to enough because the 951 elements don't encompass any sort of admissions to, specifically to conduct. I mean, you have to have a factual basis to get you through a plea colloquy. But the 951 is a little bit more bloodless than that, the elements of the offense. So it's our position today that when he offered to plead to count one and to give enough to make it a 951 conspiracy, a Hobbs Act conspiracy, did timely agree in a timely fashion to admit the offense, truthfully admit the offense comprising the offense of conviction. And as a result, the speedy trial motions, everything that continued to delay it, were outside of his ken, and he should have been given the 3E1.1B reduction. I'm out of time. Any questions?
I don't think so. Thank you very much.
Addressing the government's points with regard to the issue of whether Michael Foreman was determined correctly to be a career offender, the government discussed briefly Park, Jones, and Hondo. Park, of course, is the controlling case in this case from the Supreme Court. In that case, the Supreme Court made it clear that that it's fair to impose a burden of production on the defendant. The court used that term, production, in its holding and again in another instance in that decision. So Parks clearly stands for the proposition that a defendant has a burden of production. It does not stand for the position that the government is advocating, that the defendant further bears the burden of proof. The Jones and Hondo decisions of this court are both distinguishable, and the distinctions are set forth in our reply brief. But briefly, and perhaps most importantly, Jones was decided before both Park and Custis. And so I believe that the analysis and discussion in Jones is inapplicable after the Park decision and Custis decision came out. Furthermore, Jones was about, the issue there was the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Hondo also is distinguishable. And I want to make sure that I mentioned that I would the supplemental authority that I filed earlier this week when I became aware of it, your sister circuit to the north, the D.C. Circuit in Martinez-Cruz, addressed a situation that's directly on point with the contention of Michael Foreman. In that case, the defendant asserted that his plea was uncounseled. The defendant produced objective evidence casting doubt on whether his plea was properly counseled. He did not rely on a silent record. He did not rely on self-serving testimony. And under that limited set of circumstances, the D.C. Circuit held that the burden shifts to the government to prove by a preponderance of the evidence. We believe that that analysis is the appropriate analysis for a situation like this, the narrow circumstances just described, and that under that analysis, the court should find that Michael Foreman was not a career offender and should remand for resentencing.
Thank you very much. We will come down and greet the lawyers and then take a short recess. Oh, are you court appointed?
Yes.
We appreciate your efforts. We couldn't do these cases without the good efforts of lawyers like you. Thank you.